It is March the 1st, 2019, and this is episode 7 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Hello everybody, just want to start with an apology. This week, or this month rather, we do not have a talk from a specialist. We had a couple lined up, and for various reasons they've all had to be moved, and the one that we were going to be recording tonight for a release tomorrow was cancelled due to ill health. It's our hope to record that next week, and so what we will do is put that out as an extra next week to tack on to the rest of this podcast. So what you have for this episode is a little bit shorter, but it's a discussion with Dave Sorrell about the urgent bites from the week, the previous weeks, and also a look at some of the news, which includes a discussion around measles, the management of measles in urgent care, and the things to look out for around measles. So once again, apologies. We've tried to arrange several things to coincide with this episode, and everything just kept falling through. And then finally, we were stymied by illness. So there will be something coming. It'll be a little bit later. But in the meantime, you can hear from Dave Sorrell. The other thing to note is we're without a nurse's station this month as well. The reason for that is the Amor, who is the nurse practitioner who usually appears, has just relocated to Australia, and so her life is a little bit up in the air at the moment, so it didn't seem fair to burden her with a nurse's station. So we have that will be returning in the next one. We've not dropped that segment. So I now will hand over to myself and Dave, and we'll take it from there. Thank you. Okay, so welcome to episode 7 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose and I'm your host, and I'm joined as ever by Dr. David Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training. Hello, Dave.
Hi there.
So if we get cracking on looking back at the last month, the urgent bites that we had, let's start with the most recent one, which was the antidepressant in urgent care. And the question was, do you prescribe an antidepressant on a first visit to an urgent care clinic? And we heard from Professor Bruce Arrell on this. His story showed the flip side of what some people fear, which is if you don't do something, somebody might go and do some harm to themselves. Well, he chose to prescribe something and then they used his medication to harm themselves. And his papers that he'd written in the British Journal of General Practice discuss these, and the feeling is that certainly prescribing on the first visit is not always the best thing to do, particularly for mild and moderate depression. And so his sort of take home was to be cautious around that. We had one comment on Facebook from somebody who said that they didn't prescribe the first visit. What are your thoughts, Dave, on prescribing antidepressants in urgent care, and particularly given that we only see the patient usually the once?
Yeah, so much like the James Bond movie Never Say Never, but I try it in all circumstances to avoid prescribing an antidepressant in the first visit. Sometimes, and quite rarely, I will prescribe an antidepressant, but I have experienced the problem with patients not following my recommendations for follow-up. So I would usually only prescribe antidepressants for a short period of time, and almost always only in those who have already been on an antidepressant. So often we'll get patients saying, look, I'm traveling through and I've been on citalopram previously and I just feel I need some more. and I promised to go see my GP in 2 weeks. And it's like, in those circumstances, after a thorough mental health assessment and risk assessment, I sometimes prescribe it. Having said that, the last time I did that, and I said, look, you need to find a GP in this area straight away. And then I got a phone call 2 weeks later saying, can you do a repeat prescription? And not only do I not do repeat prescriptions over the telephone, but I would not prescribe a repeat prescription for antidepressants.
Yeah, prescribing is a tricky thing, isn't it? Because we have the ability to prescribe, obviously, being doctors, and people don't necessarily see the difference between a general practitioner and an urgent care clinic. So they will often ask for repeat medications for things that are requiring the monitoring of a GP. And certainly mental health monitoring is very important. So we don't have that ability to get people back for review. But as you say, if somebody's traveling and they've left their medication at home and they're on that medication and they need to continue it, then prescribing a week or two seems reasonable. But you were saying that that person then phones you 2 weeks later wanting another repeat, and that starts to raise a few little eyebrows, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the sort of situation where I'll opt out and say, I've given you the information, maybe 3 days prescription, the same way that you often do for people who have run out of a controlled medication, and you're absolutely certain by the way that you've checked with the pharmacists or the online test safe to say that, you know, they're not definitely not drug seeking. You prescribe a 3 day course, and similar to the Zopiclone prescription, again, when you've got other medications like that, you need to know whether it's a controlled, restrictive, or potentially addictive medication, that it is going to be safe. And if you can't assure yourself, you don't prescribe it, or you prescribe 3 days as per feeling threatened guidelines. With antidepressants, again, I very, very rarely prescribe them. I'm perfectly happy with some people who say, you know, they never prescribe them in urgent care. But I guess you have to have some flexibility, but caution, always caution.
And you mentioned the Zopiclone. That was another urgent care, urgent bite, sorry. And the statistics there was quite interesting. It's the 14th most prescribed drug in New Zealand, and 500,000 dispensings in a year. And it's certainly a drug that a lot of GPs have patients on. And I guess that we can split that into two sides. Does anybody in urgent care start Zopiclone? So if somebody's never been on it before and comes in with insomnia or having an acute sort of stress event which is preventing them from sleeping, do you prescribe in that first instance? And then you've got the person who comes in and says, oh, whilst I'm here, can I have a repeat of my Zopiclone? How do you deal with those two scenarios?
So again, the same sort of thing is you need to be absolutely certain that they're not being overprescribed. And, you know, if you can access information proving their prescription use with Zopiclone, if they've had more than two or three prescriptions in a year, then I'll say no, that you need to go back to your GP because you've had more than 2 weeks in the last year. If threatened, then a 3 day prescription is reasonable under the controlled medicines guideline. If it's a repeat prescription, well, it should be their GP doing repeat prescriptions, especially for potentially addictive medications. But sometimes you may feel forced or threatened or obliged to prescribe, but again, only in small amounts and following the recommendations of how much someone should have within a year. I mean, it's not our job to repeatedly prescribe addictive, potentially significant side effect medications like Zopiclone. So I try to avoid it as much as possible. And if there are repeated prescriptions, then I won't. Often we'll have patients present in and you can see that they've had 21 prescriptions of Zopiclone within the last 6 months or other medications like Tramadol, and then you'll say, I cannot prescribe this medication. You need to discuss it with your normal GP.
Yeah, it's. I think it's important for people, particularly if trainees just starting out in urgent care, you know, coming out of the hospital, there are drug-seeking behavior that can be very subtle, and people can seem very believable. And I've had a number of occasions when people have said they've fled from Australia, they've fled an abusive relationship, and they've just left everything in Australia, and these are what I'm on, and it includes things like Zopaclone and Tramadol. And they tell you that story, and then you notice they're back in 2 weeks later, and they see a colleague, and the story's slightly different to what you were told, and then you realise, no, this person's actually shopping around and telling different stories. So it's quite easy for us to be, because we don't have access to all the information, I suppose it's good practice to phone the GP every time somebody wants a repeat prescription of something, but if they are not available, or their GP's closed, or it's the weekend or after hours, that information isn't available to us. And sometimes these people will be from out of town, and the GP they give you might not even be the right one. So the drug seeking is certainly something to maintain a certain cynicism with everybody that's asking for these medications, and satisfy yourself that they're genuine before proceeding. But in terms of starting a Zopaclone, like being the first ever time to give somebody something, it is, by what the BPAC was saying, a very addictive medication. After less than a couple of weeks, people are exhibiting withdrawal symptoms from it. So I guess we've got to take that responsibility of, do you really want to start this person on something they might be getting reliant on?
Yes. Yeah. Do you really want to hurt them, to quote Boy George? But I think we have to be very, very careful in how we prescribe these medications, and always consider the potential harm and the potential benefit. And perhaps the harm outweighs the benefit in most circumstances.
And if a person presents with an insomnia to you, Dave, in urgent care, would you, if they then say, well, what have you done for me? If you've taken 15, 20 minutes to talk to them and examine them and describe all the things around insomnia and sleep hygiene, etc., and you've screened for a number of things and maybe considered investigations and the like, and then recommended they follow up with their GP, if they're then saying, well, I've paid for a consultation, I want a script, it doesn't really work like that, does it? The consultation is the as a whole, you've given them a full consultation. The script isn't part of that.
Yeah, I mean, we're not drug dealers, so we're not obliged to prescribe these kinds of medications. And sometimes you will clearly see that they're a drug seeker, and sometimes it's not clear, but it doesn't change the fact that you're not always going to offer a prescription. And so you've got to make a conscious decision about who you're going to prescribe and not to. And sometimes if your patient's expectations are unreasonable, you're going to not charge them because it's not going to be worth the collection, which is not going to happen. You know that these patients are not going to pay, and you'll mark them as drug seekers if clearly they are, but charging them just creates another hassle.
Yeah, and the other point from BPAC was short prescriptions if you do give them.
Yes,
a few days, really.
A few days is usually, you know, and of course they'll complain about that as well, but it's protecting everyone's interests.
Yep, tricky. If we move on to the urgent bite that was looking at scribes in urgent care. Now, this was, I guess, just intended to create a little bit of discussion. There's certainly nothing in the pipeline to make anything like this happen, but it was just an interesting study, and particularly that it was out of Australia, about how these emergency department doctors increase their efficiency, and the amount of time that patients spent in the department was decreased by having a specially trained scribe follow them around. And it just made me think, because sometimes I'm sat there typing away thinking, goodness, if I wasn't having to write all this nonsense down, I could be seeing more patients. So we asked the question, would anyone use them? And we've had a few comments from people, particularly people who'd been in the States. We heard from Kate, who'd done an elective over in Stanford, and they had these physician assistants who were doing the paperwork for the doctors in the, I think it was a plastic surgical ward and seem to increase the efficiency there. And she made the comment that it's not dissimilar to how house officers work in the hospital. So you're a newly qualified doctor and you're following the team around, doing all the paperwork and doing all the discharges and the changing the scripts and arranging the scans. So it certainly exists in that sort of concept on the wards, but that's considered to be part of your apprenticeship as you're going up through the ladder, that it's not the somebody who stays at that level all the time. And the email we had from Stephen was referencing how, I guess, if urgent care clinics grow and become bigger and take on more responsibility from emergency departments, and we're going to have patients hanging around a lot longer, and you know, that may necessitate having people to do these sorts of clerical work for us. But if you're seeing fairly minor things and patients are being discharged quite quickly, then if you're a quick typist, then you're probably going to be able to type your notes quite quickly and move on to the next person, so it doesn't become cost benefit. There isn't a cost benefit to having it. So what were your thoughts around scribes in urgent care?
So obviously there's an economy of scale. So if you are talking a large practice that's taking on a lot of tasks from ED, then there will be a definite benefit, because it means that the urgent care doctor will basically be a consultant. And what consultants do, especially in emergency medicine, is see the junior doctor's patients. And so that's what, in effect, it is. They do a quick examination, and then someone documents everything as to what's relative negatives, et cetera, et cetera. So what we usually find is in our small environments that we have to do all that work ourselves. I guess the potential is the electronic scribe, so digital dictaphones and voice recognition software, as per the radiologists. Although it's quite interesting that a lot of the radiologists still, you know, have someone typing their findings up. So where I work, I go around and the receptionists, one of the receptionists has got the headphones on and is listening to the notes and typing them up. So that's basically a scribe. And that philosophy could work well in urgent care, but who is going to pay for that person to do that? And that's where, I guess, an economy of scale. It's just another person, isn't it? And in the small environment, and most of the times, you're basically responsible for your own notes, and you have to do that at the same time. And I do know that I do my notes simultaneously, and I try to apologize to the patients as much as possible that I'm going to write the key findings down while I'm talking to them. And then I do the rest of the notes. And then I do very little notes after the patient's left. It's just the tidying up sort of thing. So I guess everyone's got their own way, and I just wish I was a better typist.
Yeah, I guess there may be younger doctors coming through who are very tech savvy and can type. And I've seen people typing and looking at the patient whilst typing, to kind of touch typing and that kind of thing. And it, if I did that, it would just be a load of mistakes and it would take longer to re-edit it all. But yeah, I guess this is something that's not going to happen anytime soon, is it? I mean, we had an email from Carlos who said that, if there were medically trained people such as the physician assistants, and this was their job, to follow you around and to do this and do that. But to implement that would take, I mean, how it's not somebody you can just find off the street here to do that. So it is going to require a big change in culture, and it's something that the hospitals might implement first, and then it would trickle down eventually to a small urgent care clinic. But it would be nice if you could walk into the patient, see and examine them, and everything you said was being recorded somehow. So all the important questions you asked were being documented, so that if 6 months later there's a complaint, you can say, well, I did ask if they were allergic to something, and they said no, and here's the proof, because it was all recorded. But
it's not written down. It's not done.
Yeah. But I guess it's an important point, particularly if clinics that you work for are wanting you to be seeing patients at a certain rate in order to keep the clinic financially viable, it does put a pressure on speed. And then as a result of seeing patients quicker, you might sacrifice something, and certainly your documentation might be something you sacrifice. And that certainly from a clinical point of view isn't acceptable if it's going to cause a problem with communication with the GP or with the hospital, or ultimately if it ever comes to a complaint, you don't have that information to hand to defend yourself. So there is a possibility that you can work too fast. And obviously if somebody has collapsed and you're getting called away to go and deal with that person who's collapsed, then you have to leave that. But it's probably good practice to finish your notes to your satisfaction before moving on to see the next patient, and to maybe resist being pressured to see people too quickly. I don't know what your thoughts on working too quickly to type your notes are, Dave, but it is a
balance, and often doctors are expected to complete their notes at the end of the shift, and then they're only allowed that certain amount of time to do that as well, or they're supposed to complete them the next day. And it's never really a good idea to complete the notes the next day. All the relative negatives and important details should be completed on the day, and perhaps you finalize some grammar or advice things the next day. But I mean, it really is a same day situation, and I pretty much do my notes at exactly the same time and finish them within 2 minutes of the finish of the consultation. So that's how I work.
Yeah. And certain things like referrals and administrative stuff can be done maybe later, but certainly the key stuff that you gleaned and found and need to document at the time is best done at the time, because you do forget things and then...
Yeah, and also you have your insurance patients. So patients who have going to claim back consultation, they need the notes when they're paying. They don't want to get the notes. And so you need to complete the notes so that the receptionist can print them out and hand them to the patients for their insurance. You know, they're not really wanting to come back the next day and pick up the notes. So that's a situation where, you know, I'll walk out and say, look, finish the notes, give them to the patient, and there we are.
So that was using scribes in urgent care. It's a thought experiment at this stage, but thank you for everybody who gave their thoughts in an email form. That's appreciated. And the final bite from this month was the pronator fat pad sign, which was a little sign I wasn't aware of until I saw it on an X-ray report. And I then looked into it and thought, well, that's quite a useful thing. And as I said in the piece, if I think the X-ray looks normal, but I'm fairly convinced this kid has clinically got a Salter Harris 1 fracture of the distal radius, if you see a prominent fat pad, pronator fat pad sign, then it can help just clarify that diagnosis for you. Is it something you've looked at before, Dave? Is it something you've considered?
Well, we definitely do use it for the elbows, for the supracondylars, the different fat pads, you know, the sail sign. That's, I guess I'm very good at looking at that. I guess I'm just not that good at the pronator fat sign. But again, I work exactly as you've described. If it's tender over the physis, then it's a Salter Harris 1 until proven otherwise. So I'm pretty much saying the principle of it is and it isn't at the same time, to work out how to manage it and then review it in a week. And then, you know, obviously really good idea is to read the reports for the patients you're reviewing, because it doesn't matter. Everything gets missed. And I guess one of the things I have to do is read all the reports for my clinic. So whenever anyone does an X-ray, I'm reading the report and then comparing it to the notes. So if there's an abnormality on the X-ray, I will review it and assess whether the management's been correct and recall the patient if it hasn't. So I guess a pronator fat pad's not going to change things too much for me in that scenario, but it's something to bear in mind and something to learn that maybe I didn't know before.
Yeah, it's just one of those little value-added extras, I guess. It doesn't change things hugely, but it helps neaten, in my experience anyway, that you see it and you think that looks more prominent. It fits with the clinical picture, so you can explain to, you know, the parent, for example, look, I think there's this injury that's going through your child's growth plate, and you can just see there's a slight bulge here, which means there's been a decent injury there. So we're going to put them in a cast and see how they are in a week's time. So it's a little value added thing just to look out for. It's certainly not as distinct as the elbow sale sign, and it probably from the statistics isn't as useful. It was interesting that one of the papers there was mentioned that they use it as then a reason to consider doing an MRI scan as the next line to look for occult fracture. And you think, well, that's nice in your health system that you can do that. But like you say, we're a bit more pragmatic and go, let's see how you are in a week and put you in a cast. But
treat the patient, not the
X-ray. Yes, exactly. So we'll move on now to some news. I think the main thing from the news point of view, Dave, is measles seems to be popping up all around the world. You've mentioned there was something, was it Costa Rica today?
I think it was Costa Rica, correct me if I'm wrong, how they had eliminated measles from Costa Rica entirely, and one patient had spread it, disseminated it through the island again, and that's a catastrophic. At least it wasn't smallpox, I suppose. And measles, again, we saw mumps last year. This time last year, I think it started, and it's the MMR vaccination, so it's not surprising that we've got measles again. And I guess measles is a classic example of the immunization herd immunity, and so the unvaccinated or unvaccinatable population will determine the prevalence of the disease, and that if you have a significantly unvaccinated population, the disease creeps up again. The other point I think that you and I discussed earlier was, how do you deal with a contagious patient that arrives at your clinic? And so I've encouraged the receptionists and the nurses to look for this actively, and try to question for contagiousness, chickenpox, measles, et cetera, and put them in a certain room. So in our clinic, T3 is for contagious patients and T4 is for protection of vulnerable patients. So if someone came in and was under chemotherapy and was unwell, we would run them down to T4 and let them stay there so they can't be contaminated by other patients. And one of the reasons for that is our slit lamp is in there, and you don't really want to leave your slit lamp with the contagious patient. So T3 is a standard room, so you can put your contaminated infectious patients in there, and you can eliminate that room without eliminating the resources of your clinic, because you must never put a potentially contagious but well patient, in your resuscitation room or where vulnerable equipment is. So for us, it's T4 for protection and T3 for contagion. And that's how we run it. But it's important to identify the infectious patients, especially in these highly infectious measles, mumps, chickenpox, rubella, influenza. You don't want to have the problem of an entirely infected waiting room. But yes, measles, again, it's all about immunization.
And it's the important thing of having an early triage so that,
yes,
you know what triage. The patient is. I think one of the things that gets me a little frustrated when these sorts of articles are in the paper, because there was one in Stuff, there's some cases down in Christchurch, and then there was a New Zealand Herald article about measles being popping up all over the States and Europe. And so it seems there's definitely a surge of cases around the world at the moment, and it just takes somebody to hop on a plane and suddenly it's in another country. But if it's in the news, people are aware of it. And so then one sensible thing that parents might do is phone Healthline that they're saying their kid has a rash, and you can't diagnose a rash over the phone. So the advice is often go and see a doctor, and they will come down to an urgent care clinic because we're open and available. And the problem then is they bring the child in, sit them in the waiting room whilst they queue to check in. And if they don't say, my child might have measles, they might be in the waiting room for 15 minutes before they make it through to be triaged, and then they can be put in your isolation room that you were just talking about. But then if it is a confirmed case, you've then got to contact everybody who was in the waiting room at that time. And if it's a busy clinic and there's a pharmacy next door and a physio and there's all sorts of people walking around, it's a hell of a business trying to contact trace them. So it isn't ideal when people drop in unannounced with a potentially infectious problem. So I guess, do you have ways of highlighting
them? Well, it's
them
interesting, or isn't them? It? How, and that's really not, it's not something we can solve, but certainly we can look at solutions. So it would be better for the nurse that's answered the phone call or the contact person to give specific information, whether the patient takes it on, as in, you know, when you go to your doctor, say, the health line said to say, I might have measles, or it might be measles, so they know to put them immediately down the room. But it is a challenge, I guess, the identification of the contagious patient.
Mm. And certainly if a parent is bringing in a child with a rash that could be measles, then they're probably better to leave them in the car and come in, or phone from the, we've actually told them on occasions to phone from the car park when they get here, particularly if they phoned ahead and said, I'm coming in, which is quite handy if they do that. We say, phone from the car park, we'll come out and see you. And then if it's obviously not a measles rash, then, or a chicken pox or whatever, then you can be a little bit more relaxed, or you can then whisk them straight through or get the room ready. But if you've got one room for that, that room might be used. So what do you do if you have two cases of measles in the same, do you put them in the same room? I mean, how do you manage that in your clinic? Because most urgent care clinics obviously have a finite size.
Yeah, it is. And then what happens if you've got two of them at the same time? That's two rooms down. And
then the cleaning afterwards, what's your policy on cleaning? Is there a set?
I put a sign up saying room needs clean, and they'll spray it with ViraClean, I believe the product, ViraClear or something. So the bed and the chairs and the desktop and maybe the keyboards, but maybe you do need to, you know, if it is definitely something highly contagious, you do need to leave it for a while, and I guess it's a reminder. And then, you know, often putting masks on is the other thing, you know, because these droplets breed infections, and sometimes they're very good at putting the masks on, especially Asian patients seem to be particularly aware of that. But maybe we should be doing that better as well.
Yeah, masks are great for, particularly I encourage members of staff to wear masks when patients are coughing and spluttering, because it's not a good way to get some time off work, or it is a good way to get some time off work if you get a face full of child cough in your face whilst you're trying to examine them. But so personal protection equipment is important to use. I guess the other thing about measles is that it's something that for a reasonable generation of doctors you haven't seen very much, whereas there was a time when you'd be seeing it on a regular basis, and some of the older, more experienced doctors out there will still have that memory bank of seeing many, many cases. But if an outbreak like this happens, it may be a doctor's first case of measles that they see. What do you look for when a patient arrives, just from a clinical, just a little bit of a clinical pearl here? What are the things that you consider when somebody is a query measles patient?
Well, it is a tough question, because most of us has not seen that much measles. So it really is that anyone with a morbilliform rash, so that Stuff article has got a lovely morbilliform rash there for you. But, you know, when you look at that picture, it's like, is this just an other virus? Is it, in particular, I guess, looking for conjunctivitis with the rash. Those two together are pretty good pickers. The coplic spots, I don't know that I would know exactly what coplic spots look like. I've seen lots of intraoral spots, but whether I would pick it. So it's that, you know, ERTI symptoms, conjunctivitis plus a rash. And then you're saying, well, it could be measles, and you're going to be swabbing them, doing their buccal or pharyngeal swab, PCR, which you're allowed to do at least, and then isolate for for the period of time that takes to get that swab back. And if that's positive, then you continue it. And if you're doing the swab, you should probably notify public health at the same time, so that it's not going to be a huge surprise for the public health people. Even if you can't fill in all the details, at least that provides two ways of follow-up, just in case it's lost to follow-up to you.
Yeah, it's the public health people are very helpful, because it's not very common at the moment, but phoning them, they put you right. Certainly the Starship Hospital Guidelines has a good page on measles, both the identifying it, and fever's one of their markers. Fever of greater than 38 degrees is one of their features, with the maculopapular rash that they say starts behind the ears and neck, and then kind of, I've heard it described as it falls onto the chest from high to low, is that sort of progression. And then, as you say, cough, cries, are conjunctivitis and the coplic spots. I think I had one confirmed case of measles that I thought had coplic spots, but it wasn't the confirming thing. It was an unimmunized person who'd been in contact with a known case, who came in exactly the right time after contact with exactly the right rash and fever and everything else, and looked in her mouth, and there were these little whitish spots, which I've been told that they look like grains of sand or something in the mouth. But I certainly wouldn't feel comfortable using it as a sole diagnostic criteria.
I'm on that Starship page, and it's some interesting concepts there that was really good. Of course, the one of the issues is things like serology. Serology takes so long to become available to us in the community. And it's really hard to work out when it's fast and when it's slow. I guess we're not really allowed to call to ask for rapid serology unless we're trying to work out immunity. So if you had a patient who was pregnant and was exposed, then you're allowed to test for IgG, and you can ask for it rapidly. But in other circumstances, it's usually take up for 5 days. And it's like, you really want them to hang around for that long? Your PCR is usually going to be much faster than that. And I certainly did order a mumps PCR the other day. I have to say it did take 5 days to come through, which was that was their entire period of isolation anyway. And so obviously you've got to be aware of the time it takes for these tests to come back.
So I guess being aware of measles, if you have an unwell child with, or an adult actually, because there's a certain cohort of people who were unimmunized for various reasons, who might be in their 20s or so now, then certainly the Starship guidelines is easily accessible, and there's loads of information there, including infection control measures and post-exposure prophylaxis. It's obviously a good thing for clinics to be aware of the staff's immunization status. Because if you have an unimmunized staff member who doesn't want to be immunized or can't be immunized for whatever reason, then it talks about measures of protecting them at work. And DermNet, I think, has got some good pictures as well. I think that's where I've gone to look at some pictures of measles. But it just certainly seems the more you look in the health news, that the more and more cases around the world are popping up. So it'll be interesting to see how our winter goes. This winter.
I'm not entirely looking forward to the flu, measles and other season in pertussis. Yes.
And the only other thing in the news was we talked last time, Dave, about your patient with the Lyme scooter injury, and we talked about Lyme scooters, and then I read in the news that they've now been stopped in Auckland now. Is that still ongoing? Yes.
As far as I'm currently aware, they're still banned, although I'm not up to the minute. We did notice a nice dramatic downturn of injuries. Unfortunately, there still are the other scooter injuries because of the popularity of Lyme. A whole lot of people decided to buy their own scooters of the large electric older person kind. So we're still getting those. From the medical point of view, it would be nice if they don't come back. From all the pro Lyme people, well, you know, they have their reasons, but it is a major medical problem.
Yeah, so watch the space. But yeah, currently they've been banned in Dunedin, and or their license has been put on hold in Dunedin and Auckland. So you'll have a bit of a stay from the injuries. And then just from a news point of view, we've got next month is the Goodfellow Symposium. You'll be there, Dave. Are you doing a talk this year?
I'm taking a year off after 2 years in a row presenting to Goodfellow. I need a presentation break. I've got lots of other things on my plate, and I didn't need the pressure of that. But I will be there to talk to anyone who wants to come up to me. Definitely there on Sunday to support you, but I haven't paid for Saturday yet. I'm just going to sort that out when the end of the month rolls over.
That's great. And yes, we will be doing a podcast talk on the stage alongside Dr. John Bonning, who is a emergency physician. He's also the president of the Faysham College, and he's a very knowledgeable person, and we're going to be having a chat with him on stage whilst hopefully, fingers crossed, recording the podcast. So it'll be a live recording, and but yeah, we should have some good stuff to learn from him. And there's lots of other talks which people can find at goodfellowunit.org and follow the links. So if you're not going, why not? It's good CME, and we'll see everybody there. So that'll be the next episode, will be hopefully the Goodfellow episode. So in the meantime, we've got a few things coming out. We've just released a trailer for the next profile in urgent care, which will be out in the next few weeks. And there's a few other talks lined up with some interesting speakers. So there's lots of good podcast stuff coming your way. And as ever, Dave, thanks for being here as the co-host and providing all your wisdom. And we will be back in a month for the next episode, and next week with an urgent bite. So thanks, Dave.
No worries. We'll talk again then.
That's great. Thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.